From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An irony of childhood in a supposedly liberated age, American children are more locked in to hyper-gendered identities by their toys today than they were a century ago. Check out the aisles at the mega toy stores. Pink aisles and blue aisles, girly girl toys and manly man toys, and less of a free zone just to be a curious kid or gender-neutral toys. This hour on Point, kids, gender, and toys. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen it in your holiday shopping, the pink and blue divide around toys? Do you embrace it or look for an end run, another way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll take a look at Mary Barra, the woman and engineer who's just been named CEO of General Motors. But first, gender and toys. We start with a look at what's selling overall this year. Joining me now from Washington is Abba Badarai, reporter for The Washington Post. Abba, thank you very much for being with us. What's hot?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
This year, what we're seeing more than ever is a return to the basics. I mean, the economy is slugging along. Manufacturers aren't really willing to take risks. And so we're seeing a lot of the same old traditional toys, Barbies, Legos, cars, dolls, those sort of items. And there's really been a sort of a throwback to a traditional era. Nobody's really willing to take chances on a toy that's completely out of the box.
Are toy companies doing okay? Have they done all right in the recession? Has it been recession-proof or, resistant, or have they been in trouble?
They've absolutely been in trouble. I mean, Toys R Us has seen nearly 2 years of dwindling profits. Toy sales have been absolutely flat for the last few years, and that's expected to continue this year. And overall, people are sort of holding tight to their wallets anyway. And so I think toy manufacturers are extra concerned for that reason.
So that means maybe back to basics on both sides. The manufacturers don't want to take risks. And what, families, if there are not surplus dollars for toys, they want to go for things that are sort of tried and true?
Exactly. And even some of the hotter toys that we're seeing this year, the Furby Boom, the Big Hugs Elmo, the Leap Pad Ultra, I mean, those are all riffs on popular toys from years past. There's really nothing new out there this year.
What about demand? Can you tell if there's, I mean, we're talking about gender-identified toys, and there are certainly plenty of those in Toys R Us, whole aisles, but can you tell what shoppers are looking for? Anything new in what they're looking for their kids?
You know, not really. They're looking for tablets. They're looking for electronics. But overwhelmingly, I mean, 26% of shoppers said they would still be buying Barbies for girls. And 11% of shoppers would be buying Legos for boys. So we're still very much seeing that gender divide among consumers.
And what about, how do you even define toys these days? Are the digital things in there as well? What's a toy and what's not?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, more and more we're seeing parents buy iPads or adult tablets for their children, which is also diluting toy sales. And we're also seeing parents sort of handing down their own electronics to their children. So I think that's been an extra sort of burden on the toy industry as well.
So when you cover toys for The Washington Post, when you cover that, do you also cover electronics or is that a separate silo?
That's generally a separate silo, but we're seeing that merge more and more with, you know, children-friendly tablets. Everybody from Samsung to LeapPad is joining the fray, and so we're really seeing those two things diverge.
Abba, do you pay attention? Have you followed the gendering of toys? You know, how much you've got the kind of long eyelash pink and purple stuff for girls and the ripped chest, war toys for boys?
You know, I haven't particularly, but what struck me when I was at Toys R Us over Thanksgiving weekend is that there are aisles and aisles of play vacuum cleaners and coffee makers for girls, and the boy section is still very much action figures and blocks. I mean, the same sort of thing that we've been seeing for decades.
We're going to dive right on into that world. I appreciate your being with us today, Abba.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Abba Badarai, Washington Post reporter looking at retail and more. Thanks for joining us. I want to bring in two new voices to this conversation. Joining me now from Madison, Wisconsin, Melissa Atkins-Wardy, CEO of the children's clothing and toy company Pigtail Pals and Ball Cap Buddies. She's also author of the forthcoming book Redefining Girly, How Parents Can Fight the Stereotyping and Sexualization of Girlhood from Birth to Tween. Blogger, activist, mother of two, a girl and a boy. Melissa Atkins-Wardy, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
And with us from Davis, California, is Elizabeth Sweet, a doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of California, Davis. Her research is focused on the segmented marketing of children's toys in the 20th century, and here we are now in the 21st, and it's going gangbusters. Elizabeth Sweet, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
So, over a big sweep of time, if I read you correctly, Elizabeth, our toys are as gender-identified and segregated as they've ever been.
Actually, I would say they're much, much more so, much more extremely gendered than anything I observed over the 20th century. So I analyzed toy ads in Sears catalogs at key time points over the 20th century. And what I found is that even at the most gendered period, there were still 50% of ads that were gender neutral. And what we see today in stores are too rigidly defined realms of toys for boys and for girls. So I think toys are much more stereotyped than they've ever been, and they're much more gender segregated.
I want to look at why that's the case. But Melissa, I mean, I'm reading here from your website. You say, apparently my daughter is supposed to be a fashion and appearance obsessed, boy crazy, prepubescent girl who turns into a thong wearing, Katy Perry singing, midriff bearing grade schooler. And my son is supposed to be a sports obsessed war machine caveman. You write, I don't necessarily agree with this at all. But you see it out there, Melissa. It's hard to miss.
It's like telling children not to breathe polluted air. Our culture is, when it comes to the marketing, it's so toxic, and the marketing is everywhere for children. It's impossible to escape. So even if I'm at the toy store not buying these items for my children and we're not watching commercials on TV, the kids they're sitting at school with are wearing these T-shirts, have these characters on their backpacks, are talking about these toys in class. And it's very, very difficult to raise children these days with the appropriate messages, and the age-appropriate messages that we want them growing with.
Elizabeth, what brought this on? I mean, compare, you looked at the Sears catalog and more over time.
Yes.
If you look back, you know, what was a more gender-neutral profile of the world of toys? What did it look like? What was different then from today?
Well, there were two periods in which toys seemed especially non-gendered, and one was at the turn of the century. I was actually really surprised that the overwhelming majority of toy ads at the turn of century were
A century ago, 100 plus years ago.
Okay. 1905 Sears catalog, I believe 80% of toys were non-gendered, and there were only two ads that specifically mentioned the gender of the child that might have that toy. So it seems surprising today because obviously gender inequality was pervasive at that time, but gender distinctions amongst children were not terribly important. And in addition, toys were just not that big of a consumer product, so marketing wasn't a key focus.
And a later period where they were also gender neutral again?
And again, in 1975, what I observed is that toys became much less gendered than they had been in the 1920s and the 1940s. And they also, there were many ads that actually sort of defied gender stereotypes by showing a boy in the kitchen or a girl building or playing doctor or airplane captain. And that change happened really rapidly. I looked at other catalogs to see, well, when did this change happen? And really, it was in the early 70s that ads became less gendered.
So we've gone back the other way. When did that happen? And can you tell what triggered it, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I think it began in the 1980s when retailers began to rely increasingly heavily on segmenting the market according to gender. And so with advances in market research, sort of narrowing the target market for a toy, that allows retailers to sell more than one version of a product to a family, which is profitable to them. Although it's interesting that gender is always the go-to for marketers. And not some other distinction. There are certainly lots of ways the market could have been segmented, and yet the toy industry has consistently, at least over the past 40 years, gone heavily towards gender.
Gender as a way of marketing, and if it's a girl and a boy in the household, they'll have to have two entirely different sets of toys. I guess that produces volume, Melissa, if volume's what they're looking for. I've seen them quoted saying, look, we're not responsible for social engineering. This sells toys.
Yeah, you know, and I take issue with that because as a parent, I want my children to have educational fun or active toys, but I'm not going to buy two of everything. I'm not buying a pink ball glove and a blue ball glove for my kids. They can just play baseball because it doesn't need to be gender segregated. Or, you know, a perfect example is Legos. My kitchen table right now is covered in Legos, and we have sets from all the different Lego lines, but we don't have it divided by the girl Legos and the boy Legos. It's just this giant pile. And it's a very duplicitous way for the toy companies to get these families to buy into their brands. And when we're talking about media literacy with kids, we're teaching our kids that the toy companies are trying to trick us. And kids are really good at decoding that. Kids don't like to feel that they're tricked. And so what I tell my kids is, you know, does a boy or girl need to play with this, or is this just for a kid? Because what we're trying to teach in our household and then through my business with Pigtail Pals is that there's many ways to be a girl and many ways to be a boy.
Melissa Atkins-Wardy, please stand by. And Elizabeth Sweet, it's great to have both of you with us. Of course, those Legos for girls and Legos for boys are out there. We're talking about boys, girls, gender identity, and toys in this hour. The great pink and bluing of toys. You can join us. Have you seen toys become ever more segregated by gender? The new engineering toy company for girls, Goldilocks, took the web by storm this season with a viral ad campaign sampling the Beastie Boys song, Girls. Their sampling of the song created some copyright controversy. The ad music was changed, but here's the original parody of the song, Girls, from the Goldilocks ad.
You like to buy us pink toys.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about boys, girls, gender identity, and toys. The great pink and bluing of toys. And the renewed push for gender-neutral toys that let kids find their own identity and interests. Elizabeth Sweet is with us, a doctoral candidate in sociology at UC Davis in California, joining us from Sacramento today. And from Madison, Wisconsin, Melissa Atkins-Wardy is here, author of the forthcoming The Redefining Girly, How Parents Can Fight the Stereotyping and Sexualization of Girlhood from Birth to Tween. She's also CEO of Pigtails Pals and Ball Cap Buddies, an online children's clothing and toy company. And boy, have we got callers on this subject for the two of you. Samara in Alston, Massachusetts. Samara, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Elizabeth and Melissa. It's great to talk to you guys.
You too. What do you know?
Hi.
I just really appreciate this conversation. I'm a women's and gender studies major at UMass Boston, and I'm also a nanny for a little boy who's four, and I couldn't agree with everything that Elizabeth and Melissa said about the completely segmented toys and books and Legos. Everything is gendered. So I just appreciate this conversation, and thanks for taking my call.
Hey, Samara, as a nanny, do you see the impact of it? Do you see the children that you interact with responding to this this tight definition through kind of color coding and everything else of their toys?
Definitely. I've been with the same little boy since he was born. And even as much as you try and push back or give different suggestions, one of your guests said there are many ways to be a girl, many ways to be a boy. Even the peers and the television, it still influences them so much that it's hard to make an impact in the way that they see gender.
And it's all over the place. Samara, thanks for your call. Here's an ad from 2010. Mattel created the fashion doll franchise Monster High. Heavily made-up dolls have what critics called Uber Barbie proportions, with waist sizes close to the size of their calves. The line features Frankenstein, Claudine Wolf, and Spectra Wundergeist.
Monster High, they're alive!
When Frankie gets worked up, she sparks up the bowl. When the moon is full, Claudine feels the pull. Glows for
Monster High Ghouls Alive dolls, each sold separately.
Monster High Ghouls Alive. Melissa Atkins-Wardy, take us for a little bit of a tour. I mean, some people will be heavily in those pink and blue aisles right now in these days looking for gifts for Christmas and the holidays, but others may not have visited there in a while. When you step into this heavily gender-segmented American toy market, what do you see, Melissa?
Well, what we see are, you know, we get the binary coding with the pink and blue for boys and girls. And as you've mentioned, we get the sexualized dolls. And then the throwback to baby care and housekeeping for girls, fashion, makeup. And that's kind of all it's really limited to. When you go through the pink aisles, the most adventurous thing you'll see a girl advertised is maybe being a veterinarian. And being a veterinarian is great, but there's, you know, maybe 2,000 other things we could be opening her mind to. And then for boys, it's similar, but in a different tone. So we get the violence, we get the war, we get the giant muscles, and we get the sexualization, we get the gender stereotypes, and most importantly, we get the limitation. When we become parents, when we have our children, we're holding this precious little life, and we're committed to giving them everything possible except this escape from the limitation. And so when we're walking through these toy aisles, especially when you're in the big boxes, you're probably not going to find the right answers that your family needs. You need to go to the independent toy shops in town. You know, shopping local is important this time of year anyway. More of the educational toy catalogs. There's several out there that are fantastic. And then some of the smaller mom-owned businesses that are truly committed to making a change in the marketplace.
Elizabeth, it's funny how our society has rolled with this. It's kind of accepted it overall, you'd have to say, or even embraced it. At the same time, as we see more and more crossing of gender lines, you've got celebrity chefs, of tons of them who are male, who clearly spend a lot of time in the kitchen, and you've got women doing all kinds of things now, you know, not least the new engineering background woman who will be CEO of General Motors. In that kind of environment, it seems somehow a contradiction to have all this pink and blue segmenting going on.
Yes, Tom, absolutely. I mean, that is actually what drew me to my project, was thinking about why are we seeing toys become so much more gendered when in the world, gender roles are becoming much less defined by gender. What I think is that, I mean, the toy industry often claims that they're doing this simply because this is what customers want. And in my research, I looked through public opinion data. I didn't find evidence at all that the public was clamoring for more gendered toys. In fact, even in 1990, when I found toys had started on this pathway towards becoming much more gendered, still two-thirds of people thought that boys and girls should have the same kinds of toys. So I don't find that, but I also think that people, as you said, they haven't fought against this until relatively recently. We're seeing more and more pushback. And I think that has to do with a few things. I mean, we've also seen during the same period that I see toys starting to become more gender, we see a stalling out of progress towards gender equality in demographics, in terms of occupational desegregation, the gender wage gap. Those things stalled out in the 1990s, and we haven't made tremendous progress since. So I think in that context, you know, people are sometimes seeking out ways to reinforce, well, I'm still performing my gender as I should be, and toys can be one mechanism of doing that.
I mean, there's been pushback, not least including little Riley Maeda. This was a YouTube video, went viral in May of 11, and here she was struggling to understand the gendered toy market. Little Riley Maeda.
Why do all the girls have to fight princesses? Some girls like superheroes, some girls like princesses, some boy like superheroes, some boy like princesses. Why does all the girls have to buy pink stuff and all the boys have to buy different color stuff?
Boy, little Riley just nails it there, Melissa. It's a good question. Do you see this as in part somehow reaction or reactionary? That is, all kinds of lines have been crossed, and now society is somehow, you know, girding itself around old gender identities? Or is this just a marketing push by the makers?
I think it's a marketing push by the makers. You know, as I'm raising a boy and a girl, they're 7 and 5 years old. I don't see them in their daily life performing their gender the way that the toy marketers would want them to, in order for our family to fall in step and be consumers the way that the companies want us to be. So I think that, you know, Riley nails it. I mean, she kind of summarizes all the books, including mine, that have been written on the subject, like take it away, Riley. She's got it down. And I've experienced it with my own kids. You know, my little boy a couple weeks ago wore blue sparkly nail polish to school. And, you know, he was armed with the phrase, colors are for everyone. And he was ready to go. And it was what he wanted to do. And it had nothing to do really with his gender or sexuality. It just had to do with him being a little kid who likes sparkles. And, you know, with my daughter, she gets upset when we're shopping for Legos because we're in one aisle looking at the default Legos, the boy Legos. And then we literally have to walk three aisles over to the girl aisle to look at the Lego Friends. And she gets the message that being a girl is different, that it's not the norm, that she's being pandered to and gets a separate set of things. And, you know, as in your first hour, we were talking a lot about Africa and the passing of Nelson Mandela. And we look at how things were so segregated in South Africa or even in the United States by race. What I ask parents to do when I'm talking with my parent community, and, you know, earlier to Dr. Sweet's point about it's not necessarily that families are asking for more gender and the toy companies are responding to us. I think that's quite a bit of BS. But I think that if we were to replace gender segregation with race segregation in toys, a lot of us, and rightly so, would become very uncomfortable. And I think that that's something we need to think about because we don't sell toys to black kids, white kids, Hispanic kids. You know, but we don't have any problem selling toys to boys and girls. And when you're a young child, all kids start at the same place. They all need to learn the same things about the world. And this gendering of the toys so steeply limits them. And from a parent point of view, from, you know, an expert author point of view, it just makes no sense to me. And I'm thrilled to see so many parents, you know, like our first caller, and activists and child care workers pushing back against this and really questioning. And, you know, the aggregation of voices in social media is having a huge impact in that regard.
The array of responses is interesting, and we will look at some of that. Lots of responses from our callers as well. Catherine in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Thanks for calling, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a mother of a 4.5-year-old boy, and I have bought him some non-traditional gender-speaking toys.
Okay, like what?
The first of which was a stroller. I'm so sorry. I'm getting the call beeping and I'm going to hit it. My son would always steal his little girlfriend baby doll stroller.
Yeah.
And walk around the zoo in our area. And I thought, well, you know, she's miserable. She's got a stroller to get away from her, so I got to get him one. So I got him one with a rag doll. He couldn't have cared less about the doll. I put rocks in it or whatever, but he loves that stroller.
Good transport, and then, yeah.
Yeah, and then he's had a kitchen he just absolutely loves. And about a year and a half ago when we were potty training him, I bought him a little boy doll that could pee.
Sure.
And he is in love with this doll. He calls him Bobby, and, you know,
right.
It's not like he takes him everywhere, but he likes to know that he's around, and I would never dream of getting rid of Bobby. And it just has been very special to him. But I know I've been aware of the disapproval potentially from especially my dad and, you know, other parents, and I sometimes put some of his toys away when he has friends over because I don't want him to be teased.
Yeah.
That's more my fear is that, you know, because they're like, well, what's this for? You know, I've heard it, you know, from
But shouldn't we have a little freedom here? I mean, I have a feeling, Catherine, I really appreciate your firsthand testimony there. I mean, Elizabeth, my own sense is that I remember a time when toys just weren't so gender. It wasn't that big a deal if there were kitchen toys. They weren't, you know, just wild pink and purple so that a boy felt weird playing with them. It was a toy, you know. You got the rolling pin and you might use it or whatever else it was. There ought to be a kind of realm of natural freedom here, shouldn't there? Didn't we even have it historically?
Yeah, I mean, this is really beginning in the 1990s is the first time that everything for girls had to be pink. So kitchen toys in the 1970s and prior were, they looked like replicas of actual product, of actual appliances. And that, I think even when they were marketed towards girls more in the 1920s and the 1940s, the fact that they actually resembled real products allowed children to use them outside of that marketing. Now, children can experience real sanctions. I know as a parent of an 11-year-old daughter who is not a fan of pink and tends to like to choose things from the boy aisle because they're more closer to her color preference, she has experienced a lot of teasing as a result of that. So I think the consequences for kids who can't fit into these increasingly narrow gender boxes can be quite severe.
The tyranny of color, just sort of kind of artificial gender layers of identity when it comes to toys. Fascinating. Now, part of this goes to the issue of the kind of toys that are then given those colors. And there's been complaint that American girls may not get as interested in science and technology and math and all the rest because the stuff in the pink aisle tends to lean toward the Barbie and all of that. A new company came out called Goldilocks, and they're taking more engineering-style toys, but giving them the girly colors, giving them that more appealing kind of pink and the rest. Here's a little bit on CBS This Morning. This was this week, the CEO of this new company, engineering student out of Stanford, Debbie Sterling, explaining how her company hopes to make the STEM field, science, technology, appealing to girls.
I did a ton of research into what would appeal to girls and what would get them interested in engineering. And what I found is girls love stories and characters. Mm-hmm. And so instead of the instruction manual that comes with a typical construction toy, Goldilocks is a series of books starring Goldie, the girl engineer, who is a role model, and she solves problems by building machines, and girls get to build along with her.
Goldie, the girl engineer, and, you know, it doesn't look like sort of a straight-up steel and bolts and nuts. Melissa, is this progress? Is this the way to get girls interested in science and technology and out of stereotypical obsessions as kids?
Well, I want to start by saying that I think it's very important that we do get girls into STEM. But the takeaway is that we need to be very careful how we do it. And we need to make sure that we're not marketing gender stereotypes or maybe posing as one thing and then being the other. So Goldilocks came on the market saying they were this fabulous engineering toy. They were going to shake up the pink aisle. And then they put out a product that's pink and has princesses in it. So while some of us were early supporters of it, you know, we've now sort of taken a second look. And I think that Debbie Sterling is coming from a good place in her heart. And I think that she's definitely started a very important conversation. I'm not sure if Goldilocks gets us there. The thing is that there's already STEM toys on the market. And it's not so much that the market needs to change as parents need to change their attitudes, because there are some great companies out there really putting important learning toys, you know, available for our kids that aren't gendered, and we're not seeking them out because we're kind of taking the lazy approach and the easy button and just going to Toys R Us and seeing what's on the shelves. And I think parents need to be very aware and make a conscious choice to change some of their shopping habits so that they can find the healthier things. And a lot of times I relate this to food shopping. We can continue to go to convenience stores and get cheap, easy food for our kids and feed them quickly. Or we can take time to go to the organic market, buy Whole Foods, bring it home and cook it for our family. And in the way that nourishes a child's body, toys nourish a child's brain. And so I think we, as parents, we need to step up and be more responsible in what we're purchasing for the kids.
Elizabeth, is there a sort of tyranny around interests here? Does it turn girls away from certain interests, just playful interests, because, hey, if it's not pink, it's not mine?
Well, I think I agree with Melissa about these pink STEM toys. I think the idea is to sort of include girls who might not normally stray out of the pink aisle. But the problem with these toys is that they really ultimately do reinforce the very stereotypes that have been heavily implicated in a wealth of research in the gender STEM gap. So we know that gender stereotypes have an influence on future career aspirations, on career outcomes, on task performance, on evaluations. And so by reinforcing the idea, as Debbie Sterling says, that girls like to read and boys like to build, it's a problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about girls, boys, gender identity, and toys, the great pink and bluing of toys. With Melissa Etkins-Wardy, her forthcoming book is Redefining Girly. She's CEO of Pigtail Pals and Ball Cap Buddies. Elizabeth Sweet is with us from Sacramento, California. She's written a lot about the history of gendering of toys. And she says we are perhaps at the most gendered extreme of toy presentation that this country, this culture has ever been at right now. Just in a few minutes, we're going to look at the new woman who is the new CEO of General Motors, an engineer. Talk about sort of a reminder that things can go every which way these days. Maybe kids deserve the freedom to go there. But it's girly, pink, and blue. G.I. Joe action figure first came out in the 1960s. The word doll was never used. Characters have been featured in cartoons, movies, and now webisodes. G.I. Joe for boys.
Cobra has infiltrated four areas of terrain: desert, Arctic, jungle, and urban. They are assembling a new weapon. G.I. Joe, Operation Hiss. You up to the challenge?
They're assembling a new weapon, G.I. Joe, Operation Hiss, and there it is. It goes every which way. Melissa, Elizabeth, interesting response from our listeners. Lisa writes to us on Facebook, says, all the toys in my house for our four-year-old daughter are gender neutral. For Christmas, we buy something she wants, something she needs, something to wear, something to read. But that can be a challenge. Laura writes to us, my five-year-old granddaughter needed a new snowsuit this month, and she specifically said she would not wear pink or purple. Laura writes, it took an incredible effort to find her something that was reasonably priced. Virtually every department store had only pink or purple in the girls' department. We ended up looking at boys' clothing. And then Kenny says, my daughter loves Lego Friends. Those are the sort of quote-unquote Legos for girls. She liked Lego before, but now it's the only thing she regularly plays with. I'm not discouraged by certain gender-specific toys. I only wish toy makers would not define activities such as sports, cooking, and crafts as gender-specific. I mean, Melissa, Lego says that once they brought out this Legos, you know, themed and colored and purposed for girls, their sales to girls more than doubled. So what does that tell you, Melissa?
Yeah, you know, Lego Friends has been hugely profitable for Lego, and the first version that came out focused on cupcake shops and beauty salons and shopping, and it was marketing the lowest common denominator of femininity to girls, and it was offensive. Their second line is a vast improvement. We've got adventure campers and karate studios and soccer practice and, you know, things that show girls being smart, daring, and adventurous, and we need more of that. So my tone has kind of softened on Lego Friends. I was pretty hard on them in the beginning. I'm a much more neutral on it now. You know, in all three of those comments that you read, you know, they're right on point. And the problem with Lego is that in the 90s, they pushed girls out and marketed solely to boys. So then they tried to bring girls in, and they did it in a way that was, there's a very strong difference between girl-centric marketing and authentic girl empowerment. Myself and my colleague, Michelle Yulow from Princess Free Zone, we wrote about this a couple weeks ago in response to the whole Goldilocks implosion. And you can put girls at the center of your product and try to market it, but if you truly don't understand girls from the standpoint of how parents are raising them and what their wishes and hopes for their and aspirations for their daughters are, but more specifically what those things are from the girls themselves, you're going to fall and you're not going to have a successful run with your product. So I'm glad to see that more girls are building and getting engaged in Lego, and that's fantastic. But the problem is with Lego, you know, when you take the company as a whole, females are only 16% of the minifigs. When you go into the default Lego aisle, the boy aisle of Lego, and you look on the sets, all the little faces of the minifigs have stubble and very square jaws and are, you know, very clearly defined as men. So I think that's improvement. I think Lego still has a lot of work to do. I think they're on the right path. But, you know, when we're talking about how this limits the kids and how the kids then face peer pressure and they're confined to these little gender boxes, my son has a little girl in his class who is a darling, but she has Lego shoes and she likes to wear Super Mario Brother t-shirts and dinosaur t-shirts. And some of the girls in her class were gender policing her and saying, you know, that's for boys.
You shouldn't be wearing
that?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so, well, and then interestingly enough, this all took place during my son Benny's two-week run of wearing the sparkly blue nail polish to school. So he and his little friends formed this act of solidarity, and he wore a dinosaur shirt on the day that she was going to wear it to show the classmates that dinosaurs are for kids. Right. It's not for boys or girls. And I think that's really what we need more families doing, is just getting back to the essence of childhood and remembering what it was like to be a child and that the whole world was full of wonder, and just get out of our kids' way and let them choose their path. But not so much that we let the marketers define that for them, but truly offer, and I like to use the word gender inclusive instead of gender neutral, and Dr. Sweet can talk more about this. We actually, she and I had a very big conversation about this last week on our social media pages. But gender inclusive means that it's for boys and girls, whereas gender neutral kind of takes a different tone, and that there's a right and wrong way to do it. And I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do gender. I think we just need to let kids be kids.
I remember the time when there would be a huge box of blocks, and they were not boy blocks or girl blocks. They were just blocks, and they were
just
great.
Blocks.
Tim in Great Falls, Montana. Tim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me good.
Very well. Very well.
Call screener said she's having a hard time. But anyway, I'm the only one that I've called in today that's male. I don't have a problem with gender neutral, but in a society where are the men in the lives of our children, 50%, I would guess, I'm just using a figure, 50% come from divorced families. Who's raising these kids? Their moms, these young boys. I think, this is my opinion, that girls need to have their role models. They have them, but who's our role models for our sons? They're their mothers. I think the caller, and I think it's a little bit skewed in the sense that they're looking at it from a woman's perspective. If we're all raised by our mothers, we're going to be more, I don't want to say feminized, but we're going to be softer as men, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think in a society where 50% of the men or young boys are raised by mothers, who's their role model?
But does that mean, I mean, I understand what you're saying. It's a very interesting question when you have so many single moms raising boys and girls. Absolutely, it's interesting. But is G.I. Joe the cure for that, Tim?
Is G.I. Joe the cure for that?
Is it the cure? Is it, does G.I. Joe, you know, you give the kid, the boy a G.I. Joe toy and that fixes it?
No, definitely not. What I'm saying is the role, I think there's a big problem with not having the male role model, as well as a female role model.
Yeah, it goes right beyond toys in that case. I think we've got the point. I don't know, Elizabeth, what are you thinking as you hear, you know, Tim's concern there? Is the hyper-gendering of toys and then supplying those to those boys the answer to the big social issue that he raises?
No, I don't think so. I mean, one thing I think Melissa talks about, there being many ways to be a girl and many ways to be a boy. I would argue there are also many ways to be a family. We see an incredible diversity of family structure in the U.S. right now. And I don't think that this is so much something that we should be fearful of. I think our roles and the way they're defined by gender are changing, and that's okay. So being a parent doesn't necessarily have to be defined by gender. And I think boys can learn very important things about being a parent and being nurturing through toys, just as girls can learn very important things about being in careers and future occupations and building through toys. I don't think that reinforcing the idea that these interests and skills have to be completely defined by gender is helpful in any way.
Tim, I appreciate your call. I understand the concern you're raising there. And it's funny how it intersects with toys. I mean, that's bigger and broader than toys. Melissa, you've got a son as well. Does he feel out on the market, boxed in, or more free than your daughter when it comes to what's available to him, to his freedom to roam across the spectrum of things to play with out there?
You know, yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of, I have answers that sort of contradict each other. In the toy market, boy is the default, and then girl is the special product, the other. So in that regard, he's used to seeing the world cater to him because we live in a very, you know, masculine society where the male is always the default. So sort of no. But then on the other hand, we also live in a society that's extremely, even though it's 2013, homophobic. And so we get a little hinky when our boys are wearing princess dresses or playing with pink or walking around with baby dolls. And, you know, in that regard, he is boxed in by gender. So we just kind of let him pick his toys. And we stay away from the violent toys, though. We don't go down those aisles.
Well, there's a big range, but it sure is deep pink and blue these days. And the significance of that is something to ponder. You really help us do it wonderfully, and I'm grateful for that. Elizabeth Sweet at UC Davis, joining us from Sacramento, California. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Melissa Atkins-Wardy at Pigtail Pals and Ball Cap Buddies, author of the book out next month, Redefining Girly. Melissa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
In a moment, the story of General Motors' Mary Barra, the first female CEO of a major American auto company, GM. This is On Point. For more than a century, Detroit's Big Three has been a kind of old boys club. America's auto industry giants have always had a man in the driver's seat, the top job. Not today. After announcing CEO Dan Akerson's departure at the end of January, General Motors named Mary Barra as its next leader, the first woman to run a major car company. She spent more than 30 years at GM and rose up through the ranks from intern to engineer to product development head. Now she will take her seat in the top office. Yesterday, here she is from an interview with the Detroit Free Press. General Motors CEO-elect Mary Barra saying she was looking forward to leading the company.
I've worked at General Motors for 33 years, and I've always known it's a great company. The men and women of General Motors are so dedicated, and I truly believe we have the best team on the field. So it's an honor for me to be able to lead this team.
A woman will be the CEO of General Motors. That's a new day. With us now from Detroit is Jerome Vaughn, news director at WDET-FM. He's seen the rotating cast of CEOs at each of the Big Three for years and followed Mary Barra's rise to GM's highest office. Jerome Vaughn, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So the board had options, and they chose Mary Barra. Why?
Well, so many reasons. Sharp, incisive, dedicated to the company, really good at her previous job. She's had several in the company over the past, 33 years. And by and large, the short answer is she was a rising star. She was recognized for her talent, and the board decided she's the way to go.
What's her background? It's GM in the family. I think I read here her father worked for GM for years.
Right. And she started as a co-op student back in 1980 at Kettering University, went into the company, held a number of jobs, including a plant manager at the Detroit Hamtramck plant. She did a stint as head of human resources, even though that wasn't her background. During that time, she loosened up the dress code so everyone didn't have to wear suits all the time at the company. That really set her apart. She became head of product development, and the company really saw the results that she put out in that respect. And as an example of that, just yesterday, three General Motors vehicles were set out to become either car or truck of the year. That's half the field, and a lot of that can be credited to her.
Can you remember any other time when this could have happened? I mean, we just associate the big car companies with men. And when there's top executives come out, we have for years and years seen men. Is there a wave of women coming up to these ranks? Is this a very unusual, particular woman who made it to this altitude?
I would say she's not unusual. I think she had the skills, she had the talent, she proved herself. But I think in addition to that, it happened at the right time. General Motors went through the bankruptcy several years ago. That really shook the company up in a lot of ways and forced it to get away from the way it had always done things, because that was no longer working. That gave younger people a chance to rise up through the ranks. That gave a chance for new people and new ideas to really come to the fore. Mary Barra was one of those people who really took advantage of the chaos. And Dan Akerson, the current CEO, said as much, that, she came into a situation where there was chaos and really helped shape the company and move it forward.
What do you know about her style of management? She's held lots of positions already.
Well, one of the things that she's really known for is having, you know, a cooperative sense of management, of getting people to reach some consensus. But at the same time, she's very focused. She knows what she wants to do and knows how to get it done. Those things working together have made her someone who people like to work with, that people have some loyalty to under her, and has helped move her forward.
An engineer, a woman, and she'll be CEO of GM. How's GM doing? We know that just in the last few days, the federal government got out of its last holdings that came with the bailout. How's GM positioned for her first year ahead, Mary Barra's first year ahead?
They're in pretty good shape. The stock price earlier this week was at a record high post-bankruptcy. There are several new vehicles in the pipeline coming out. As I had mentioned, you know, three vehicles on the North American Car and Truck of the Year list as finalists. All of that has set her up in the right direction. At the same time, the economy is not as good as it could be. There's always competition in the auto industry, so it's not going to be a free ride for her by any stretch of the imagination. But the people inside the company say she's the person to get the job done.
GM rode SUVs and trucks for a long time. Does she have a different sense, maybe, of where the emphasis will be, or a different design sense?
Her design sense is give the people what they want. Quality is the main thing. Keep the quality up, and that will keep the customers coming in the showroom. That's really what she's going to stay focused on.
Jerome Vaughn, news director at WDET-FM in Detroit, filling us in on the new female CEO-to-be of General Motors. Jerome, great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation here every day and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. And if you can go to our Facebook page, sign up there, you'll know what's coming up the next day. Hit the like button. You'll get alerts on our upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Great to have you with us today. As always, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.